Nina Totenberg. This is The Connection. All is not right in Mudville, even as Barry Bonds threatens to break Mark McGwire's record. And the team with the smallest payroll, the Twins, is still a contender. Major League Baseball is in danger of striking out. In 1922, the U.S. Supreme Court, see how I got that in, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that baseball is not a business, but a pastime, and therefore exempt from the antitrust laws. Today, a closer look at this unregulated monopoly raises major league questions about the way baseball is running its $3 billion a year industry. Why are there so many teams and most of the money in the gloves of a few owners? And why are so many major league stadiums empty while the minor league ballparks are bursting at the seams? Connection listeners, what do you think needs to be done to bring back the fun and love of the game? No pitches too wild to consider. Get into the batter's box and call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. And joining us in the studio is Michael Gee, sports columnist for the Boston Herald. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
And also joining us on the phone from Smith College is Andrew Zimbalist, a professor of economics, who's written extensively about the business of baseball. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Nina.
Do I call you Andrew or Andy?
Andy would be great.
Okay, Andy. I'm going to actually start with you about the business of baseball. I'm going to read you something from the Sunday, I think, New York Times, which I happen to know that Michael Gee disagrees with the article, so I'll start with you. The Times reports that the average attendance for the league, the major leagues, has still not recovered to the levels that it was at before the 1994 labor dispute. And I should note parenthetically here that the labor contract is about to run out, so we're about to have all these problems all over again. And despite a long economic boom, the construction of 10 stadiums, a doubling of the number of playoff teams, and the addition of interleague games pitting, let's say, the Mets against the Yankees, the attendance rates are still not way up there. Meanwhile, the fall of the television ratings for games makes the National Football League look good, says the Times, and the number of children playing organized baseball is plummeting. So, Mr. Zimbalist, Professor Zimbalist, studier of baseball as a business, what do you think? If you had one recommendation to make to baseball, what would your recommendation be for reviving the fortunes of the sport?
I think, Nina, I would start with a slight modification of the analysis that you just gave. All of the individual statements that are made there are correct. For instance, it's true that attendance has not recovered to the 1994 level, pre-strike level, but it's almost there. In other words, in the beginning of 94, it was up around 31,000, and now it's around 30,500. The sport has also doubled, more than doubled its revenues since 1994, and there are many, many good things happening.
So you don't think we're on a death watch unless we do something?
There's no death watch. There's no cataclysm. The sport can certainly improve itself, and I do have a number of recommendations, but I don't think that this is a life or death matter by a long shot. It seems to me that, particularly from an economic perspective, there are a few things that I would point to.
But just tell me one to start out with.
Okay. Well, I think that there's imbalance in the game. Everybody knows that the Yankees have won four of the last five World Series. Everybody knows that since 1995, out of 189 playoff games, only three have been won by teams in the bottom half of payrolls. And it's becoming more and more the case, for a variety of reasons, that teams can buy themselves a much higher probability of victory, and that is threatening fan interest, the fan bases, and half.
And so the solution is?
The solution is that baseball has to move gradually towards a system of more revenue sharing amongst the teams.
Like football.
Not nearly as far along as football has gone, but towards that direction, yes.
Well,
Michael Gee.
I'd just like to say a few things, that historically these economic imbalances between haves and have-nots in baseball has existed basically since the National League was founded in 1876. It's an internal problem they've never been able to solve, and that the Yankees were just as dominant under the old economic system where money was theoretically not as important in the 30s and 40s as they are today. Maybe more dominant.
But let me just interrupt you here a second, because as I understand it, I don't know what it was, a decade or less ago, the ratio was between the Yankees, let's say, as the ultimate rich team, and the ultimate poor teams was about 3-1, and today it's 20-1, and that's a big difference. You know, 3-1, give me 3-1 odds in an election, and I might be able to win, but 20-1 is pretty tough.
Two things have happened. One, of course, is that salaries have escalated, and as long as there's a free market, they always will. There are more people in our society with enough money to buy ball clubs than there are people who can hit 340 or win 20 games. It's the only area of life where supply and demand works for labor and not capital. The other thing is that the bottom teams have deliberately downsized themselves. They're not even trying to win, which feeds a vicious cycle. Because when fans pick up on that, they stay away in droves.
Now, you should explain why that is. That has to do with something that happened after, I guess, the 94 strike. Was it the 94 strike?
Yes.
Yeah. So, Professor Zibilis, quickly, explain why that is.
In 1996, when they signed a new collective bargaining agreement, they introduced a revenue-sharing system. And in that system, the teams that finished with the lowest winning percentages get the most revenue sharing. The Yankees kick in about $22 million net dollars a year into the pool. Other teams kick in slightly less. The teams on the bottom can get from the pool about $20, $25 million. So you actually, if you're looking at your team at the beginning of the year and you decide your team doesn't have a chance to win, then your profit-maximizing outcome is to lose as much as possible and get as much revenue sharing as you can and spend as little as you can on the team. So the revenue sharing system that they introduced is profoundly flawed, and they need to modify that. But with regard to what Michael said, surely there's always been imbalance in baseball. The two problems right now is that baseball has much more competition than it did in the 1930s and 40s or even the 50s and 60s. Back then it was alone on the sports pedestal. Now it has basketball and football and many other sports coming along the way. So they have to do a better job fielding a competitive and attractive product. The other thing that's much different today, and Nina, you alluded to this, is that the perception that teams can buy championships today is much clearer and much, much sharper than it ever was before, and that affects fan interest. So baseball does have to do something about the competitive balance.
Well, it's not just an illusion. It happened. I mean, was it the Miami team that you know, brand new team buys enough talent to win and then decides I don't want
it? It happens and it doesn't happen. Spending is no guarantee of victory. Not spending is a certain guarantee of failure. That's an immutable truth.
Mm-hmm.
But the Dodgers have spent as much as any team in baseball history over the past few years. No success. The Orioles spent fortunes in the past decade.
Stupidly. No,
well, that's just it. Anyone can spend money. It's spending money wisely. The other thing is, it's a chicken and egg cycle.
But
you don't just win because you're spending. You spend because you're winning. If you're successful, you have to reward the players who were part of that success.
Which brings me to my mini rant here, which is the owners. I've never really blamed the players much for greed because, you know, they have a short time to make the money they can. But just the mere fact that you have enough money to buy a baseball team guarantees neither wisdom, nor sports savvy, nor decency, nor even acting in your own best self-interest, apparently, where the owners are concerned. Mr. Gee?
And that's always been the case as well throughout history. The American League was formed as a breakaway effort when players were willing to go with people who wanted to start a new league because the National League tried to impose a salary cap of something like $400 a year or whatever it was. Again, folly and sports ownership go hand in hand. It is certainly not just limited to baseball. And it just seems to be something about sports that reaches the inner sap in American rich people.
And you don't mean the gooey stuff either.
No.
Well, you know, they don't really have a real commissioner. They've got one of their own as commissioner, the ultimate, you know, chicken in the fox in the chicken coop. Nonetheless, they are facing a reality here, which is that their labor contract is about to be over. Mr. Gee, any prognostications about what the Sappy owners will do?
There are two things working here. One is, thanks to their intense dislike as rich people of being pushed around by their employees, they might again attempt to provoke a work stoppage. On the other hand, the last one, which was only 7 years ago, cost each side $1 billion. On the verge of the biggest bull market in history, you can probably say safely they could have made that $2 billion if they just kept it. So that memory might still be fresh enough to provoke some kind of compromise.
And what are the rules? Refresh my recollection, as they say in court. What are the rules for the baseball owners doing anything? They have to have two-thirds vote, or what are the rules? They have to have a majority vote? I mean, if they decided, for example, the TV revenues were to be shared equally by the teams, which is, I think, more or less what football does. Professor Zimbalist, do you know what the rules are?
Well, it depends. The rules are different for different kinds of changes. If, with regard to revenue sharing, it needs to be three-quarters. With regard to a collective bargaining agreement, generally, it needs to be two-thirds. So it depends upon which element in the agreement that you're talking about.
So any one of the creepiest owners could, just a two or three of them could screw up the process pretty easily.
Well, you need more than two or three. I mean,
you need four or five.
You need seven or eight to veto changes. And one of the largest problems here, Nina, is that the owners, because of the fact that you have some teams like the Yankees with revenues over $200 million and other teams that are up around $160, $170 million, and then you have teams like the Expos that have revenues down around $50 million, is that the owners have very different economic experiences of what the baseball industry is all about, and hence they have very different ideas about what needs to happen to change the industry. And so to have collective bargaining where you have at least three groups of owners, the high revenue team owners, the middle revenue team owners, and the low revenue team owners, each one with a different idea, before collective bargaining begins, you have one side in the collective bargaining effort disagreeing amongst itself. And what traditionally has happened in that context is that the owners come to the table only agreeing on one thing, and that thing is that they'd like to see salaries lower. But all of the other changes that could improve the game, they disagree about. So they come to the table with one idea, whether it's a salary cap or a luxury tax, and the players are essentially being called upon to make a unilateral compromise. And that's the formula that has produced all of the work stoppages in the past. This time around, we have the same problem all over again. And as Mike points out, there's also the experience of being deeply chastened by the devastation wrought as a result of the work stoppage in 94-95. But I think the first issue is getting the owners on the same page, getting them to agree amongst themselves about a balanced plan for reforming the game. If they can come to the bargaining table with a balanced plan that entails bilateral sacrifice, I think the chances to get to the end game and avoid a strike or a lockout are much, much greater.
And Middle East peace is right around the corner before that happens, too.
All right. We're talking about what's wrong with Major League Baseball this hour on The Connection. What's your game plan for fixing America's national pastime? Get in the game when we get back. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Nina Totenberg. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Connection listeners, I'm Nina Totenberg, and we're talking about some of the major league headaches for Major League Baseball. One of them is that fans are flocking to the minor league games. Let's listen in.
And on the mound tonight, for your national pride, number 18, Marty Jansen. Bandits, Dairy Queen family night tonight, and every Monday and Tuesday of the season, they pay this DQ Blizzard treat. Is celebrating its sweet 16th birthday with outrageous new flavors.
And And joining us now is Billy Johnson, general manager of the Nashua Pride. And we've also got in the studio Michael Gee from the Boston Herald and Andy Zimbalist from Smith College, who's written a lot about the economics of baseball. But Billy Johnson from the Nashua Pride. Minor league games are a lot of fun, and they're a lot cheaper, and you can get really close and see what's going on. And it's not a lot of rich folks in fancy boxes, but fun and promotions are a big part of it. What do you do for promotions?
Well, what we do for promotions probably isn't a promotion at all, really, not to sound too difficult. I don't think we do too many things far different than major league promotions. We're going to give away caps. We're going to have the chicken visit. We're going to give away, you know, a lot of free stuff to sell tickets. But I think that the success of minor league baseball is actually a lot of the things that may not be going right in the major leagues.
So what is the chicken visit again for anybody who has not seen the chicken?
Yeah, the chicken is coming September, I believe September 10th is when we have him scheduled this year. But you talk about, you know, what the minors are doing right, and I don't think it's, I think probably it's more of accessibility to kids. You know, we stand in line, we see the kids get autographs here at our park, and they're getting guys who, like Sam Horn and Chad Fonville, a couple guys have been in the big leagues, and they're just as happy to get those autographs as some of the big leaguers, and they can get them. You know, we don't have labor issues down here, so, you know, it's not a distraction.
You don't have labor issues because your players are bought and paid for, right?
Well, actually, for us, we're independent, so actually I do negotiate the contracts with all of our players. We're not subsidized by a major league team because we are an independent farm club, but this is more of a real gut check of the type of player that we have down here. You know, we're not in a situation where our player pool, you know, there aren't too many industries in the world where you're paid a guaranteed contract on potential to the tune of millions of dollars. I wish I could get paid on the next potential 5 years.
What's the average for one of your players?
For one of our guys, if you've been in the big leagues for 5 or 6 years, you're going to make $3,000 a month.
And if you're starting out?
If you're starting out, you might make $1,000 a month.
And is your park full?
Our park is full on weekends.
And how many people does the park hold?
We hold 4,200. So, you know, Friday, Saturday nights, you know, we'll be jam-packed. And then the weekdays, we're creeping up over 2,200.
And how much does it cost to go to the game? What's the range?
$7, $6. And if you don't want a back on your chair, you get in for $4.
And kids don't need backs on their chairs. God knows they don't need backs on their chairs.
They're running around anyway.
Yeah, that's right. They're running around anyway. And are you making money?
Are we?
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, not in Nashua just yet, but we're about to. It's been a four-year project for us here, and we may see black ink this season.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Gee, sports columnist for the Boston Herald, are high ticket prices a problem, let's say, outside of Boston? Because we all know Fenway is almost always sold out. But outside of Boston, are high ticket prices the reason that people aren't going to games?
Well, it depends on where. It's just like Broadway. The health of the theater as an institution depends on what show you want to go see. It's not just Boston. You can't get a ticket at Safeco Field where the Mariners play. The Giants are selling out every game. The Indians are selling out every game.
But there are teams, one of the California teams, I can't remember which, you know, that are winning teams where they're playing to half-empty stadiums.
Oakland has been that way since time was. I walked up and bought a ticket the day of the seventh game of the 1973 World Series there. It's another special case, although they're doing better now.
Professor Zimbalist, why is that? Why is that ticket prices? Is, you know, Oakland is not the richest of communities. On the other hand, it's right next to Berkeley.
Well, you know, part of it is that baseball stadiums, depending on the stadium, have capacities of 45,000 up to 60,000, and they play 81 home games a year. So it's much, much more difficult to sell out a baseball season than it is to sell out a basketball or hockey season or even a minor league baseball season. And it's been an accepted outcome going back to the the beginning of the last century, that you don't sell out your games. I do think there's an issue here, which is, and it was alluded to in the New York Times article that you mentioned earlier, and that is that with the new stadiums, baseball increasingly is catering to the top 20% of the income distribution. The new money that the teams get from the new stadiums, it's usually between $30 and $50 million a year, is coming from the luxury boxes, from the club seats, the season ticket sales, from catering, from signage, from corporate sponsorships. That's all corporate income. It's all very high income individuals. And as the shift has gone towards the high income individuals, there are fewer and fewer seats that middle class America can buy. They can buy some seats, and it varies from park to park, as Michael says, but they're not the best seats in the house. And the real danger for the sport in the long run here is that baseball, since the 1980s, has been the American national pastime, and it happened when the old National League was challenged by a new league in the early 1980s, charging 25 cents a game to get in. That's when you appeal to the masses, when the masses could get great seats at that price. It was 1881, actually, that the American Association did that. So, you know, as these ticket prices creep up and up, and you could still maybe get a seat for $10, but they're cruddy seats, then the vast majority of the American population breaks its habit of going to baseball games. And in the long run, that's going to hurt baseball. So baseball has to find a way to change the mix.
The economics is the minor leagues are a response to that. I mean, the Nashua Pride are cheaper than a movie. They are well within the anybody's income reach, and they do well. The team that is not 10 miles away from them, the Lowell Spinners, the Red Sox Class A affiliate, they're sold out for every game, and their ticket prices are on roughly the same range. And the minors' explosive growth, what was thought of 40 years ago as a dead industry, minor league baseball, is because they're offering an affordable product. And to tell you the truth, not one fan in 100 can tell you the difference between Class A baseball and Major League Baseball when you're watching them play.
So the market really has filled the void that was created by the hotsy-totsy prices in Major League Baseball.
Right. There are two things that we look at when we define our product and our price points. That sometimes you look at the major leagues.
You're going to look at them without me for a second, though, because I got to go to some callers. Craig is on the line. Craig, go ahead.
Hey, how are you? Great show.
Thank you.
Great topics. As far as the regular listener, though, and the regular person, you know, baseball's very intelligent and it's very, like, smart as a game. But, like, all us everyday earners of $30,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $100,000, us men at, like, $33,000, $34,000, we get a little pissed understanding and knowing what the personal life of the baseball player is due to the media. They take us too close to the game where it's almost not worth going to the game because we're so aware of the ins and outs, the owners, the players, the managements, the GMs.
You don't have to read it, you know.
Say what?
Well, he does have to read it.
If you don't want to read it, you can just go to the game.
Which is a great aspect of Boston. I thrive on all the media that is given to me.
This is called approach avoidance.
I 100% feel like I don't need to go to tonight's game because I read what's going to happen already, and the players are affected by that. And I talk to everyone else, and say Omar, a guy who used to play for the Sox. Now he's out there in Cleveland and stuff like that. We hated him because of how much we knew what he did in his own family life, you know. But he could have had the same mysterious life as Babe Ruth, who was known as a player who was out there doing his thing, smoking cigars, drinking, playing, but was able to execute.
Actually, if you went back to the library and read the news clips of covering Babe Ruth in the 20s, he did not get a free pass. It was widely known and widely reported that he was an excessive personality. People just didn't care.
All right, we're going to go to another caller. Jerry is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Go ahead,
Jerry. How you doing? I just happened to have finished a novel on the Brooklyn Dodgers. And what this gentleman just now is saying really gets to the heart of it. There's an arrogance. It's not just money. It's the arrogance that comes with money. I think it screwed up the game. I have a couple of points I hope you'll indulge me with. I used to watch the Dodgers stand on the roof of their dugout and sign autographs for an hour. This is true, the Brooklyn Dodgers, not the L.A. Dodgers. And a few years ago, I saw Reggie Jackson, the last day of the series, they just won. Everybody's all excited. They all ran on the field. This one guy runs on the field with his hand outstretched to Reggie Jackson. Jackson lowered his shoulder, knocked him in the stomach, and knocked him out of his way. A guy who was trying to congratulate him. One other point I want to make. From 1947 to 1956, I have this in my book, the Brooklyn Dodgers won 6 pennants. In the 45 years since then, the Dodgers have won just 9 pennants, 4 by 1966, which, as I say, is while they still had Brooklyn dirt under their fingernails. There's something changed. The money has screwed it up. I'd much rather go to the local small team here and not care at all who wins, but who wins the pennant. Who cares about that? It doesn't matter to me. I'd rather the game is a beautiful game, and it's being destroyed. I agree that the players should get more money. It shouldn't all go to the owners, you know. But something's lost, and I frankly don't think it can ever be regained.
Money changes everybody. And there is money breeds nouveau riches in any field are noticeably pompous and overly solemn about their lot in life. And baseball players are no exception. There's no different that the baseball players I cover today are different in the way they approach life than the ball players I covered when I was starting out back in the mid-70s. And I think that's just inevitable. I mean, you know, it's like when rock and roll people decided they were artists. It's too bad, but there's just nothing you can do about it.
Well, you know, Jerry raises a question. One of the suggestions, I think it was by one of the Vec brothers, was why don't major league teams put out one player, a rotating player, every game to sign autographs for, I don't know, 20 minutes, a half an hour after the game? Why not?
It's a good idea. It's not going to make the problem go away because there's always going to be somebody at the end of the line who won't get his autograph signed and people behind that person, and they'll be angry and they'll complain about it.
Yeah,
but it's a good idea. It's a good idea.
And also, only kids.
We do it here.
You do it at the Nashua Pride.
We do it in Nashua. 40 minutes before the game, we make 2 of our players sit at a table for 20 minutes.
As part of his rituals, invariable rituals, Nomar Garciaparra signs autographs about 20 minutes before every game and about as many as he can in 10 minutes. Of course, they're never going to be able to sign all the autographs people want. I think it's noteworthy that America's fastest growing sport, NASCAR, those guys are signing autographs right up to the minute they get in the cars to go on the track on race day. And that's a sport where they bury the Bill Buckners. So it's like, you know, that's like, I have very little sympathy for those ball players who say they need to maintain their focus.
Yeah, well, I do have some sympathy for the Reggie Jacksons running off the field because no matter how well-intended those of us are who might be running on the field, just take 100 of us and you can hurt somebody with your good intentions. We're going to go now to Carolyn, who's calling from Elmira, New York. Carolyn, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Carolyn Hopkins. I am the Public Relations and Media Director for Pioneers Baseball in Elmira. We are a member of the Northern League of Professional Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm listening intently to what you're speaking of, and I think that getting back to baseball on this level, and we are pretty much AAA.
I hear that you've done some really interesting promotions at the park in Elmira. Tell me about those.
See, we're national.
Yeah,
we're getting
national
attention. That's one of the things that we do to help bring people into the park.
What do you do?
We tend not to have too many giveaways, and we have a lot of corporate sponsorship here. But we do some interesting things, including having the Blues Brothers come. We do a diamond dig. We do baseball binocular giveaways.
Do a diamond dig, what are you digging for? Cubics or two-zirconia?
Diamonds. You're actually digging for diamonds.
A diamond?
Yeah, an It's one diamond. It's provided by a local jeweler, and there are also cubic zirconiums out there, and we open up the infield and give, actually sponsored by Dig Safely New York and the jewelry store and one of our media sponsors, and we had a drawing, and people were able to go out on the field and actually dig and up our infield looking for diamonds.
What happened to the infield? Oh, my God.
Well, we did it on a day where we didn't have games for a couple of days, so we could repair it. Mm-hmm. And people had a lot of fun. There was a lot of good media coverage from at the jewelry store.
And lawyers? Lawyers? I hear you did something with lawyers?
Yes, we did.
What
lawyers
did you do?
Paid double the amount, and we had a dunking booth. So you were able to dunk your favorite attorney, and part of the proceeds went to legal aid. So we spend, during the wintertime, we spend a lot of time trying to think up interesting promotions that do bring people to the ballpark. But the majority of the people who do come to our park are coming here for baseball. They're coming here because we've got young men who are out there playing for the love of the game. And that's what you see on this level, as opposed to
elsewhere. And what do tickets cost in
Our tickets start at $4 for senior citizens, $5 general admission, regular admission, and you can sit in a box seat for $8. We have 98% of our box seats sold before the beginning of the season.
And how many people in the park when it's full?
When it's full, we can seat 4,021 people. We hit the 4,000 mark this year, which is the first year since we've been under the ownership of John Irvin, which would be 4 years, that we have had that capacity crowd. That happened to be a night where we have one of our corporate sponsors that does a fantastic job.
And I'm not going to let you mention the corporate sponsor. Thank you very much, Carolyn.
We also have fireworks are a good job. So we do a lot, and it does help, but I think that people need to get down to see the beauty of the game and really need to start coming to baseball. Even though we have a lot of competition, it is our national sport, and we really need to patronize as
thank
much
you,
as
Carolyn.
We
the
can.
Thank you, Carolyn. Mm-hmm. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Gee, I noticed nobody so far has called in and said the answer to baseball's woes is to get rid of the designated hitter rule.
Well, it would shorten the games, which would make sports writers' lives easier, but it's unlikely to happen. I mean, again, this is a symptom of baseball's internal problems. They can't get together to decide how many guys should be on a team between the two leagues. Makes it difficult to think that they would actually come to an agreement on serious economic issues.
Well, we're talking about ideas to reinvigorate baseball this hour. Former Texas Rangers owner President Bush is doing his part bringing T-ball to the White House lawn. But what's your pitch to bring back the fun and the glory? Join the conversation when we return. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Billy Johnson, thank you for being with us. And we're going to stay with Michael Gee and Andy Zimbalist. I'm Nina Totenberg. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. We're talking about ideas to re-energize baseball and put the fun back in the game. What's your winning idea? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Or if you're numerically challenged, it's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Michael Gee from the Boston Herald, Andy Zimbalist, professor of economics at Smith College. And just before we went to the break, I mentioned President Bush as the former Texas Rangers owner, and in the break, Michael Gee, you mentioned something to me about the presidential campaign. I'll let you do it to the...
It says everything you need to know about Al Gore's political abilities, that he had an opponent who was running, a member of one of the most despised groups in our society, Major League Baseball club owner. That's like running against an arsonist. And he never mentioned it.
But to give him credit, George Bush loves the game and promotes it at every turn, doesn't he?
Yes. And again, it's hard to say that an industry is in trouble when it has the president of the United States out there pitching his product. He was at the ball game in Colorado last night. I think he's probably seen more ball games than many sports writers so far in his administration.
Well, we're going to go do some more calls. But before I do that, when we left, I said the designated hitter rule. Andy Zimbalist, a professor of baseball economics at Smith College. It is you know, whenever you talk about changes in baseball, there are always people in the room who want to talk almost exclusively about the designated hitter rule. And as much as I love baseball, I can't really get all excited about that as a change in that rule is somehow changing the game intrinsically. Do you think?
No, I can't either. I mean, there are people who take religious stands on this question,
like Rudy Giuliani.
Yes, and I can't get behind that at all. I mean, I clearly in my mind there are pluses and minuses to it, and I don't particularly care that one league does it and the other doesn't. It doesn't matter to me that there's some variation. Michael is right that the DH does make the games a little bit longer, but I don't think making the game three hours instead of 2 hours and 50 minutes has much to do with baseball's popularity. I think part of baseball's popularity has to do with the fact that it's an antidote to the quick pace in our life. It's a time when you just slow down and relax and you don't worry about time. That's one of the beauties of baseball. So I don't have strong feelings about the DH one way or the other.
Professor Zimbalist must have been watching Hideo Nomo out on the mound last night because he makes time stand still.
I couldn't bear to watch. I've gotten to the point with the Red Sox after how many years? When I started out with the Record American in Boston and used to go to games, I actually thought we might win a pennant. Now I think it's part of one's makeup to suffer long and hard with the Boston Red Sox, to have your hopes dashed every year.
Well, you're going to have some new ownership that will bring you championships.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, sure, right. Yeah, and we were going to get a new park, too. Derek is calling from Indiana on line four. Derek, talk.
Yeah, thank you. This is Derek from Indiana. Hey, I wanted to make a comment on the baseball card collecting these days and all the different name brands of cards. See, back in 1986 or 85, they started making different brands of cards and just kind of got me disinterested in all of the card collecting, and that's how I got familiar with the game, watching them play and knowing I had their cards and looking at their stats. And but back in 77 when I started collecting, there was like tops, like couple different brands of cards, and nowadays I believe there's 15-20 different brands to collect.
Do kids collect cards, Michael Gee, at all anymore? Is there a baseball
do,
video game or anything
some
like
do,
that?
But what's interesting to me is the whole idea. This is another spin-off effect of the baseball economic boom of the last 30 years, is that the two newest developments in fan behavior are collectibles and fantasy leagues. That is to say, ways fans can make a buck off the game, too. It's almost like a defense mechanism.
Hmm. Professor Zimbalist, let me ask you something. We've been talking sort of optimistically about the game, but if the owners act as they always have before, looking in the long run, it does seem that the game is in some trouble.
Well, I don't think so, frankly. I mean, I think that baseball has the same problem that the other major team sports have, which is that there are a lot more options out there today, not only from new sports, but from more TV channels and the internet and other activities to distract people in our society. And for that reason, they have shrinking ratings. They've gone down modestly over the last 10 years. But as we said at the beginning, attendance at the games is doing well. And I think that what baseball needs to concentrate on is managing itself well. I think it needs to manage its political relations well. They're talking about contracting the number of teams. That would, in my view, be devastating. Baseball needs to expand, not contract. As our society grows, as cities become larger and larger and per capita incomes in cities grow, there are more and more viable cities out there. If they want to get little leaguers involved in playing the game, they need to put baseball teams in cities like Portland, Oregon, and Sacramento, California, and Las Vegas, Nevada, and Washington, D.C. They shouldn't be taking teams away. They should be adding teams slowly, but that should be the direction of change, not the other way around. I don't take the extreme view on ownership that Michael has articulated. I don't think that they're universally hated by a long shot. I think there are many baseball owners who are leaders in their community and viewed as such. And I'm hopeful that their views will prevail as the owners sit down to talk about what kinds of changes they're going to recommend to the players. I'm somewhat optimistic that they're going to make positive changes for the game. It's not going to be easy, but it has nothing to do with whether or not, as Michael suggested, they can agree upon the DH.
Baseball owners are like Congress. They may be liked individually, but they're despised as a collective body.
Actually, as I think through the ones in the actual existing baseball owners, the only ones who are really liked are from smaller communities who have been there a long time, like Bud Selig. Most of the others are, I go to Orioles games now because I live in Washington. And the owner of the Orioles is not widely admired.
Not widely admired.
And as I think about it, what's his name at the Yankees? I see how
Steinberg.
I feel. People would probably like to meet him, but they also love to hate him. Don't you think, really?
I think that the bottom line is that people actually have a lot of admiration for what Steinbrenner's done to that team, although I think he's done a lot of things that are reprehensible. But you have leaders out there like Peter McGowan in San Francisco, who are widely respected in the community, and I think that he's a very positive force, and there are other team owners like that who are very positive forces who go to the owners' meetings and insist upon balance, insist upon moving the game forward, and I think that they might well prevail.
That's what we do, too. We insist upon balance at National Public Radio and at WBUR, and that's why we have you here defending the owners when neither Michael nor I will. Andy is on the line. Go ahead, Andy.
Hi. This conversation, I'm an American historian, and this conversation is a perfect example of why baseball is truly representative of America, because it's a national pastime to talk about how the past was better. And it seems to me that baseball has never been healthier than it is now, that there's more competitive balance in the 70s and 80s since free agency than ever before, that the pool of players that they draw from is larger than ever before, and that in terms, even with the competition, in terms of attendance and things like that, baseball is in many ways as popular as it's ever been before. And this notion that somehow the game was better in the 50s or the 40s or even the 60s is just not true at all.
Well, in the 40s and most of the 50s, first of all, there were no African-American players, and I don't think any Latino players to speak of. Were there?
Not many.
Yeah.
Not many. And certainly there was no such thing as Japanese players. But
certainly not.
You know, I mean, probably, maybe even the bigger story in baseball this year than Barry Bonds has been Ichiro Suzuki. The guy is an unbelievable talent. And if baseball is going to expand its talent pool worldwide, it can only be good for everybody.
We're going to go to Bob now, calling from Richmond, Vermont. Go ahead, Bob.
Hello. Am I on?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. This is the statement about attendance being fine. I got a question on is the attendance fine because the tickets are sold out, and is that because are there plenty of seats available to families that can afford it, or are those seats sold out to corporate seats? I remember going to a Bruins game a few years ago and noticing that a good third of the seats were empty, but the game was considered sold out because corporate seats were held. And I think the problem is that families can't afford to spend the day going to the game unless you're in the upper income bracket. And I just like to know, are all those seats, you know, really, is the attendance really that well as far as for families, or is this basically corporate seats that are being used to entertain clients and what have you?
Your observation.
And I'll leave the phone and take the answer off. Thank you.
Your observation is generally correct. However, the average attendance per game is around 30,500 today. And I don't think there are any stadiums in the United States that sell more than 8,000 club seats and more than 1,500 seats to the luxury boxes. So you're talking about one-third of the seats that are being sold to club seats and luxury box holders. The rest of the seats are being sold to individuals at a variety of prices. Most of those individuals are well off, but there's still a lot of regular people going to the ball games.
There are many people at Fenway who hold some of the good and most expensive seats in the park who have been going for a long time and have just put up with the ever-escalating ticket prices because it's their recreation. It's the part of their life and that they use as recreation, and they're willing to spend that share of money on it.
Let me ask you a dirty little question before I go to the final one, and I really would like a quick answer to this. If you go to any baseball, Major League Baseball game in America, and you think about it, you have to notice that there are relatively few African Americans in the stands. I assume, really, that that's because of the history of the game, of the exclusion of blacks, which has still not been overcome entirely, in addition to the economics. But is there any effort, let me just ask you, Professor Zimbalist, is there any effort to market to the African-American community particularly?
No, there is. I mean, individual teams have tried it. Bob Watson tried it in Houston, but there's no concerted effort, and there needs to be. But marketing seats that cost $10 and $20 and $30 isn't going to help you, because most low-income individuals are not going to be able to afford those seats, no matter how much you market them. So
but there are plenty of African Americans with money now.
Well, that's true, but you know, you have 1% of the attendees at these games are African Americans, and there's simply the probability of attracting African Americans, because of the fact that they have lower per capita incomes, is much lower. So part of the problem is marketing, and part of the problem is the cost of seats. And again, I think something has to be done about the income mix of people that are being attracted.
I saw more African American fans at the U.S. Open, Southern Hills Country Club, Tulsa, Oklahoma, than I see at Fenway Park. And let me assure you, the U.S. Open is not a cheap ticket, but it has a lot to do with the transforming effect of Tiger Woods, that in that community, the African Americans with money were willing to pay top dollar to have the opportunity to see him.
Okay. Thank you, Michael Gee, sports columnist for the Boston Herald, and Andy Zimbalist, professor of economics at Smith College. And thank you, too, to Billy Johnson, who joined us earlier. He's the general manager of the Nashua Pride. We had help today from Kim Bashari, Darren Mnuchin, Tim Monroe. We say goodbye to our intern today, Tom Jacobois. The Connection is produced by Graham Smith, Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, Karen Schiffman, and Doug Sugars. Today, our senior producer is Tara Murphy. To continue the Baseball Connection, you can go to our website, theconnection.org. I'm Nina Totenberg. This is The Connection.